This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Partisan scorn comes in many forms, and schadenfreude may be the most satisfying. When Bible-thumping, family-values reactionary Judge Roy Moore gets accused of sexual assault, the horror tends to be accompanied by a thin smile. Such satisfaction at the enemy's hypocrisy can be so rich, in fact, that partisan critics strain, sometimes absurdly, to locate it. Such is the case with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, newly elected member of Congress from New York and avowed Democratic socialist. How to prove she's a phony? Her clothes, of course.
And then there's this. The rising star of the Democratic Party has expensive taste for a socialist. Congressional candidate Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez spotted posing in a $3,500 outfit.
Wait, what?
For a photo shoot for Interview Magazine. Her pantsuit, appropriate, retailing more than $2,800 alone. Ooh. And the shoes, $600.
It's tough being a socialist.
The onslaught of aha may have peaked in November when Washington Examiner staffer Eddie Scarry tweeted an image of Ocasio-Cortez, taken from behind, with the caption, "I'll tell you something, that jacket and coat don't look like a girl who struggles." Obviously, if money were an object and she truly cared about the people, Ocasio-Cortez wouldn't dress fashionably. Does she think we're all fools? It's an absurd attempt at gotcha, but it turns out not an uncommon one. Einav Rabinovich Fox is a historian at Case Western Reserve University, and she's documented a long history of media obsession with the clothing of outspoken women. Einav, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
The press seems forever to have a bone to pick when it comes to radical women's fashion. We could start earlier than the last couple of centuries, but for the sake of this conversation, can we begin with the bloomer costume of the suffragettes? How did that look affect their cause, for better or worse?
The bloomer costume was introduced by Amelia Bloomer around 1850. It was part of a broader movement for dress reform. At that time, women wore corsets and very tight clothing that really prevented mobility, movement, and even breathing. And the idea was that in order for women to be independent politically, they also need to be independent physically. They adopted the bloomer costume really wholeheartedly. But the bloomer costume contained trousers. It was long trousers that were covered by a skirt.
Now, this was a kind of double-edged sword. The clothing was explicitly political, but not necessarily in the ways that it was interpreted. And it kind of helped the movement and it kind of hurt it as well, no?
The fact that the costume did contain trousers made it seem very radical, like they're trying to be men. And that made people really scared, especially when they also demanded the vote. They were living in a small village in New York in the 19th century, and very, very quickly, it became kind of like a national sensation. The New York Times picks it up, gave them a lot of publicity for the suffrage cause, but maybe not the publicity that they wanted. And so despite the fact that they really thought that this kind of like, this is the future for women's clothes, they preferred to go back to kind of like more traditional appearance in order not to upset too much, because their radical messages was upsetting enough.
Now, by the turn of the century, the suffragists, and earlier I had said suffragettes, which was a kind of term of art at the time, but to modern ears sounds quite a bit condescending. So the suffragists changed their tactics. They appropriated convention and style. Their clothing, to the extent that you can generalize, became kind of elegant, no?
Yes, very much. That was part of their campaign strategy. They felt that if they really want a constitutional amendment to pass, they need to convince men that they are not as crazy masculine women who want to, you know, change everything about this world, but actually very feminine, likable, respectable women who will, you know, clean up politics and make politics better. This is why they wanted to vote. And I mean, the Bloomer debacle was really in the back of their mind. They were really careful not to make those mistakes again. They were also, most of the suffragists were middle class or even upper middle class women. And that also kind of like helped them to create that image of this non-threatening suffragist.
All right. So Bloomer mania was one example that the Ocasio-Cortez wardrobe fixation reminded you of. But there's another. Please tell me about Clara Lemlich.
She was a garment worker, and she was the leader of the very famous 1909 garment strike that is known now as the Uprising of the 20,000. It was really a watershed in terms of how the labor movement conceptualized women as workers and as political subjects. And a lot of had to do with Clara Lemlich, very frustrated from the male establishment of union leadership, gave a very famous speech and called for a general strike. The next day, 20,000 garment workers brought the industry to a halt. The strike itself lasted quite a long time, for 14 weeks. In the end, strikers got a lot of what they asked for, which was not just better wages and working hours, but also safer working conditions and restrooms and mirrors and hooks in the bathroom to hang their clothes. It was a combination of bread and butter issues, but also something that for strikers were very important in terms of work culture, but the male leadership dismissed that as not important.
Now, Clara Lemlich was fed up, but the general strike was not spontaneous any more than Rosa Parks's refusal to move on the bus was spontaneous. It was well planned. To what extent did the strikers think about their image, their wardrobes, as part of their statement?
Most of those women strikers, you know, we can actually call them girls because many of them were under 18, and they enjoyed early 20th century New York City. And for them, the ability to wear the latest fashion, even if it cost them the entire weekly salary, was a sign of their economic independence, the sign that they can spend their own money on what they choose.
They dressed up for the general strike.
They dressed up for work as well, not just for general strike, but yes, it was part of their culture. They worked hard for that clothing of theirs, and they want to show it off.
And this got a kind of a tut-tut from some in the media. There was a Collier's Magazine reporter named Sarah Comstock who saw how they were dressed and thought it made them ridiculous.
Union leadership was very invested in portraying them as young, helpless victims of this capitalistic system that we need to help. And here you go, these women going with their hats and furs and fancy dresses that was very kind of like in contrast to the image of those helpless victims. And part of their argument is that we can demand our rights as workers for better wages and better hours, and also have our own right to spend our money on what we choose. We don't need to look like poor women just because we are.
They refused to play the role assigned to them by the patriarchy. They were willing to be called frivolous. In fact, it actually turned out benefiting them, right? Because they achieved their goal.
Yes, they did. They were really careful to do that strike on their demands. In one point, the male leadership kind of like went to the back room and tried to negotiate the terms, and they got back to the strikers, and the strikers said, no, this is not enough. We want union recognition. We want better and safer working conditions, and we're not going to back off. So it was really a part of their realizing that they can do it on their own terms. And one of their own terms was, we're going to look the way we choose to look and not the way you telling us to look.
Now, there is one horrifying footnote to this story that, you know, probably doesn't really mean anything except for its shocking irony, and that is the achieved settlements with, you know, almost all of the garment factories in Manhattan, but there was one notable exception, a holdout, a company that did not cave to the demands, the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory.
Right. And as much as the strike was kind of like a climax point in their battle, the Triangle Fire that happened only a year after the strike ended was really a horrifying reminder of the urgency of their demands. When their demands are not met, this is the result, the worst industrial disaster in New York for that time and really up until 9/11. Lemlich worked at Triangle and she knew many of those women who died in the fire. It was a very traumatic event, but it was also a very traumatic event to the city in the sense that they really understood that their strikers' demand for better working conditions and safer working conditions was not a frivolous demand.
Ex post facto, it conferred a kind of righteousness to their cause. I wonder if it also had the effect of tamping down complaints about frivolous clothing choices, whether critics after the 1911 fire were less likely to focus on the outfits and more likely to focus on the grievance.
Definitely. And the 1909 was a very important strike, but it definitely was not the last strike in the garment industry. In fact, between 1909 and 1915, there was a series of strikes. But you don't see as much as criticism on women's appearance, and partly is not just because of the horrifying effects of the Triangle Fire, but also because the 1909 strike really proved the public that women are serious force in the labor movement, that these are organizable political subjects that really know what they wanted. They're not those frivolous girls who just care about clothing and movies and dancing, but they were really political actors. Both of these events really showed people that it's not about the clothes that they wear, but really about the grievances that they voice.
Einav, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Einav Rabinovich Fox is a historian at Case Western Reserve University. That's it for this week's podcast extra. You obviously can't get enough of On the Media, so I commend our newsletter. You can sign up at onthemedia.org/newsletter.
WNYC Studios is supported by the community of writers, presenting live online short courses in the Writers Annex. Upcoming in 2024, Sylvia Plath, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Emily Dickinson. Instructors include Victoria Chang, Robert Haas, Brenda Hillman, Peter Orner, and Matthew Zapruder. Learn more at communityofwriters.org.